Okay, so I guess we're just going to do a little brief introduction. My name is Gordon Mussel, and I am doing a phone interview with Dozier Jones, and it is November 6, 2014. It is exactly 4 o'clock, and the file number on this is number 40. This is for Voices Ahead of the Curve, and it will be deposited in the University of Dubuque archives. So I guess just to get started, I'd like to just get a little bit of background about you, you know, where you grew up and where you came from and what that was like.
Wow, you asked me to go back a while. I was born in the South, of course, a little area called Franklin County, Georgia. My father and grandfather were sharecroppers, and we moved between Georgia and North Carolina. When I was about 5 years old, we moved from Georgia to North Carolina. And we lived in a little town called Statesville, North Carolina for a few years. And when I turned 18, I decided that I wanted to go off on my own. So I left home at that time, Statesville, North Carolina at 13, and decided to move to Atlanta and live with a couple of my older sisters. That worked all right for about the first couple of years, because as I was a growing boy, I was eating too much. So my brother-in-law, of course, asked that I consider doing some other things. So through my church at that time, which was Ebenezer Baptist Church, and the Martin Luther King Sr. was the pastor of that church, who was the father of Martin Luther King Jr. So it was at that church where I found some housing with a lady as a boarder, and I boarded with her for a couple years as I went through high school at Booker T. Washington High School in Atlanta. And then I decided that I needed to do some type of work, and I started become a busboy at a place in Atlanta called Leb's Restaurant. And at that time, in order to be more flexible, I know I needed to move into a space where I could come and go at different hours of the night, so I moved to a boarding house. And believe it or not, my roommate at that boarding house was an African-American. Not African-American, he was African. And he's from Ghana, and we shared a room, and in that boarding house, I stayed with a wonderful lady for about 3 years until I went on to college. Now, the high school I attended was a school called Booker T. Washington High School in Atlanta, and at that school, I played football, tried to play a little basketball, and a little baseball as well. Did pretty well in school. Had some wonderful, wonderful teachers. And it was my football coach that came up to me one day and he said, where are you going to college? And I hadn't thought about it. I was a senior and I probably was January or so when he approached me, and I told him that my goal was to get a real nice job at Leb's Restaurant as a waiter, make a lot of money, buy myself a 57 Chevy, get married and raise a family. And he very quickly told me that I think he should go to college. So at that time, apparently, he knew of a gentleman by the name of Sam Johnson that worked for, I think it was the Presbyterian Foundation, and they were recruiting African-American kids out of the South and other parts of the country, but primarily the South, and sending them to various schools, what we call then up north. So they sent my football films to the University of Dubuque. Another very close friend of mine was a football player. They sent his film to the University of Wisconsin. And then another friend of mine was an ex-tennis player, and they sent his information to Purdue. Hmm. So the young man that went to the University of Wisconsin and I said, well, we were not going to go to school unless we could go to school together. It's college, that is. So finally, we knew we had to get in. I couldn't get in because I was about 25 pounds smaller than my friend. He was, at that time out of high school, about 210, and I was about 195. So I sent along to University of Duke. University of Duke gave me a partial scholarship, athletic scholarship, and the rest was was from a loan from the school. Not a loan, more of a grant, I guess you'd call it there. So I was accepted. University of Duke in 1962. Never forget my first experience, and I'm going to break for a minute and let you ask some questions. When I got to the Duke, I took a bus from Georgia, of course, to the Duke. When I got off the bus, I walked into this bus station. It was really interesting. I saw no black people. Now, mind you, in the South, all you see at that time, you would see is black people and white people. So I thought I was at the wrong place because I'd never been to a place where I did not see a black person. So I walked out on the sidewalk and stood there for a few minutes, and there was a student. Obviously, he knew that I was black. So he knew what he was looking for, but I had no idea who was who I was looking for. But I went back in the bus station. I said, what town is this? The gentleman said, it's Dubuque, Iowa. And I immediately thought, oh, my God, what is this? So the Jim Meyer was the guy that picked me up. He was an upperclassman, lived in Dubuque. I later became a fraternity brother of his. But Jim picked me up in this Chevy convertible. I forget the make it was, but we were riding from the bus station up to the university, past this park, which I think is still down on University Avenue. And the first thing I heard from a kid was, hey, nigger.
Wow.
Yeah, and I said to myself, I said, God, what did I get myself into? But that was just the beginning. It turned out that that little incident there was just somewhat of an awareness that I was in a different place. And it was not a place I'd ever been in. I've been around white people all my life, but we were always separated. They did their thing, I did mine. I was usually in a work environment. Never had conversations with anyone of a different color except topics related to a job or something of that nature. So it was quite an experience to all of a sudden have a white roommate in college. That where we shared a room, talked, and to go into a cafeteria where it was all white. When I first got there, there was only two African Americans at that time. And I think there was an exchange student, again, a gentleman from Ghana. But it was a young man from Chicago Heights. His name was Bob Johnson. And, of course, it was not unusual for him to interact with whites because he grew up in Chicago Heights and went to an integrated school. So Bob helped me out quite a bit as far as being able to discern who was actually being open and honest and who was not. So with that, I'll stop it. If you have some questions, that was my first year there in 1962. Actually, 63 it would have been, I believe. And Bob and I were both freshmen. Bob was a linebacker, and so was I. I need to tell you this real quickly, though. Bob and I both were admitted into the Phi Alpha Kappa fraternity.
Okay.
And Bob had gone on a flop weekend. It was about a year after he was there. You know, as tradition would have it, you know, all the fraternities would go away for the weekend and in a lake or wherever, just party, have a good time. So Bob and a couple of guys were out on a boat, and we don't know all the details. In the evening, they could have been drinking, so the boat flipped over, and Bob drowned in May of 1963. So of all the things that happened at the University of Duke, whether it was racial comments or whatever, that was the most devastating one for me, to lose someone that was so... I guess helpful in helping me adjust into an environment that I feel was going to be pretty difficult.
Mm-hmm. And that wasn't so after too long after you'd been there.
No, it wasn't. The thing that hurt the most. But I had some great friends at the university. friends that I talked to today, my big brother in the fraternity was Harold Knutson. Harold and I still communicate. The best man at my wedding, Chuck DeFarcus. Chuck and I still communicate. The first guy that invited me to his home in Iowa was Keith Kephart. Keith Kephart and I still communicate. And there are several others. Joe Calapity, who was a young guy on the football team a few years after I was there. We still are in touch. Bill Saluga. These are people that you probably have run across, or you see their names and things around. Mm-hmm. Rick Anderson. And I could go on and on. I don't want to miss anyone, but these are people that really had a significant impact on my life, and many of them still do. I'll never forget the first time that I went pheasant hunting with Keith Kephart and Chuck DeFarcus, Dave Bacon. It was in, what town was that? I forget. It wasn't Deep Witt, Iowa. But anyway, we had gone pheasant hunting, and that's the first time I'd ever been pheasant hunting in the South. I'd done some rabbit hunting and things like that. But I remember calling my mom, and I said, Mother, look, I'm going pheasant hunting. These guys invited me to go out with them, and I'm not sure if I really want to do it. I said, I don't know if they want to take me out there and shoot me and say it was an accident. And that was the honest God truth. But she asked me some questions and finally said, go ahead, son, they're reaching out to you. They're just trying to show you a little love. So I went on that trip, and if you ever talk to any of those guys about my first hunting trip, it was a time that I shot a skunk. I was out. We had spread out, and all of a sudden, this rabbit skunk started charging me, and I kept asking the guys, what should I do? Finally, Chuck said, shoot it. So they talk about that today, about me going pheasant hunting, and I ended up shooting a skunk. But let me just say a little bit about the support I got from the professors and so forth at the school. It was a gentleman like Couchman, who was the president. He was one outstanding man. I have a little list of people that I keep. I have a list of mentors, and I have a list of who I consider to be true angels of God, and that God brought us together. And John Couchman, Galen Couchman was one that I felt truly was an angel. And he never forgot your name. He knew who you were. He would always talk with you. I mean, not just talk at you, pull your side. Had some wonderful conversation with him. Had numerous holiday dinners at his home. Once in a while, he gave me an opportunity to babysit and earn a little money. And John was his son at the time, and I would ensure that he was behaving. Just great people. Just great people. The first overcoat, real warm overcoat I had, I can't remember the professor's name now, but he was a part-time professor, was one that was given to me. He probably saw that I was running around in the Butte with a jacket on in the middle of the winter. That's because I did not have a coat, a big coat. And he gave me one of his coats. So it was very, very quickly that it was people like that that changed how I felt about how we as a nation were separated in some ways, but in a lot of ways we were not. If you were, you showed a lot of love in our hearts, a lot of respect for the individual, then there was nothing wrong with being friends. And at Dubuque, there were more real, loving, caring kids than there were those who were a little concerned about me being there or felt that I didn't fit in. But overall, it was a wonderful, wonderful environment. I'll never forget the team doctor. He was on the board of trustees. Paul Lobby was his name, from Dubuque. And another gentleman, like Dr. Couchman, would always come up to you and talk with you, ask you how things are going. I don't know if you guys have pictures of Marge Kramer anymore. She was a lady that kind of ran the cafeteria food service for us. And another angel that showed love and appreciation for a lot of the African American kids. And Gordon, they didn't single you out. They showed it to all the kids. And you being part of that group, they didn't just say, I'm going to go talk to Billy because he's black. They talked to all of us that way. And they cared for all of us. And my leadership skills on the football team, my leadership skills in the Marine Corps, my leadership skills in Vietnam, I was a Iraqi platoon commander, was all enabled, all started there at the University of Dubuque, because there I had people of all different ethnicities and backgrounds that I befriended and I got along with. So when I went into other areas, whether it be the Marine Corps or corporate America, it was my experience at the university that helped me to communicate with and to lead people of different backgrounds and from different parts of the country and the different colors. So it's one of the most important steps I think I took in my life. And as I say, I'm still connected with many of the friends that I made at Dubuque. So that's a little quick story about where I'm from and who I am. So, I'll let you come in. I know I talked a lot, but
no, that was great. I guess to step back just a little bit in time, you said where you had came from at Booker T. Washington, that they kept blacks and whites very separated, like, you know, like as if there's still segregation going on at that time. What was that kind of like?
At that time, there were no schools in Atlanta that I knew of that were integrated. That was back in the late 50s and the 60s. I went to a very nice school. We had all the greatest books. We had one of the teachers. We had our own athletic programs. I think the only time I recall any black kid in Atlanta going to a white school, be it middle school or high school, was probably a couple of years after I left there. Maybe a year after I left there, which would have been 62, 63, something like that. But we were separated. And as I said, now, what's interesting, when I lived in Statesville, North Carolina, for a short period of time, I lived on a street called Sharp Street. And on that street, for about, maybe about six or eight houses were all blacks on this one street. In my backyard, behind me, was another street, and all the whites lived on that street. Huh. And what was interesting about that is that our backyards butted up to one another. And the kids, the white kids that lived in the house behind me, every once in a while would come over and play. Or we'd go over there. But we would never go into each other's homes. Nor would we be seen doing that anywhere in the street. And this is why I'm thinking, I'm telling you, 8, 6, 7, something like that. But I divert back to that just to say that it was never an opportunity to be in an environment day to day assimilating with, associating with black kids. And it's amazing that so many people who had similar situations were able to associate with and compete in some ways with many of the white kids, you know, when they went on to other schools where they had integration and so forth. But no, I had no white kids at Washington High School. It was on the west side of Atlanta. It was probably about five blocks from Morehouse College, Clark Atlanta University, Morris Brown College, those traditionally black colleges. So it's really interesting about Atlanta. They had pockets where, and it still exists in a lot of cities, I'm sure. They had the west side of Atlanta where I lived, and the east side, they had a school called Howard High. It was probably about six all-black high schools in Atlanta at that time, and a representative number of, you know, elementary and middle schools. They were all black again. So, as I said to you, when I got to Dubuque, that was the first time I ever shared a classroom or definitely a room with whites.
Wow. And there was no white instructors or anything like that when you were at Booker T?
None.
Wow.
Not a one.
And I guess you said you had planned on being a busboy.
Yeah.
Right. Right, a waiter.
Going for a waiter.
Right, know. Right, a waiter after, and was that a typical thing, then? You didn't really have the aspirations to go on to college.
Great question. I was a real good student. I was smarter than I thought I was. I did not know at the time. I remember I left home at a very early age. I had no parents or grandparents there saying to me, don't you really need to go to college? I think the thing that really made me receptive was having gone to Ebenezer Baptist Church and meeting the King family. And that church talked a lot about four-year education. But once I moved out of the lady's house, there was a member of that church to the west side of Atlanta. I sort of lost a lot of that, but parts of it stayed with me. Such that when my coach mentioned to me about going to college, and then it all started coming back. All of us kids, that is, most kids, you know, you see your role models, and the role models I had at the time, they were younger, who were seniors ahead of me, but they were young men. They were guys that drove really nice cars. They wore tailor-made slacks. They had all the girls chasing them down. They either worked in a restaurant or they work in one of the utility companies, and to me, they had made it. And it wasn't until, like I said, the coach talked to me and told me about the other opportunities that I changed. I thought, I'll get me a 57 Chevy, put blocks on it, get me a job at Lev's restaurant as a waiter. Now, a waiter makes a little more money than a busboy. I get a busboy.
Mm-hmm.
My next level as a black in that environment was becoming a waiter. And that was a good job because you didn't see a lot of black waiters at that time. So that's kind of how that happened. That's why I had no aspirations about college. I had no upperclassmen that came to me and said, Dozier, I'm going to Morehouse College or I'm going to Fort Valley State. What are you going to do? Again, it was a coach of mine that said, what are you going to do about college? And at the time, going, I had no idea. I did not know. And I had counseling at school, but I didn't seek their support. I had no idea what I needed to do to get at. And I'll never forget this gentleman's name. His name was C.C. George, and he was a football coach. I was a linebacker, and I was a guard in high school. C.C. George was a coach for the ends, the tight ends, the offensive ends, and so forth. So it was by the grace of God that he reached out to me. The coach I had obviously didn't ask those kind of questions.
Mm-hmm.
So Coach George is one of my angels as well, because that was nothing that I did. That was just God knowing that this was supposed to happen. Did I ask your question?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And you said the name was Sam Johnson, correct? That was with the Presbyterian Foundation that had helped you get to the university? Did they do that?
Yes, they did. In fact, Alice Stubblefield is from Georgia as well, and she was part of a group that came up from the South. I think she was from Thomasville, Georgia. And there are several others, I can't remember all their names, that were part of that program. And again, I forget the exact name of the foundation, but they were going after bright kids out of the South that could assimilate into, or they felt they could assimilate into, the white schools in the North. And there were kids that went to Simpson College. I don't know them. They were behind me. As I say, my good friend Nathan Jenkins went to the University of Wisconsin. My high school buddy Art Powell went to Purdue. So that was all spurred on by the Presbyterian Foundation and Dr. Sam Johnson.
And they just helped you, it kind of helped you with, like, expenses just to physically get there? And
yes.
Admissions and all that, and that whole process?
Exactly. And like I say, the UD had a level of funding as well. And in those days, you know, it wasn't anything like it is now as far as cost. So with the subsidy that you may have gotten from the foundation, and any scholarship money that the university had, you were pretty much able to have somewhat of a full ride, with the exception of personal expenses. And I want to add this too: the university was very, very open in helping many of the kids, those of being black or white, with jobs on campus or jobs in town. I had an opportunity to work in the town of Dubuque in two areas. One was the post office during the holiday season, but I didn't have the funds to go back to the South or Atlanta during the holidays. So I would work. The other place I worked was one of the gymnasiums in Dubuque, where they had intramural or kind of city league basketball and stuff like that, and I was a referee. That didn't go over too well, because if I didn't make the right call, I wasn't treated too well. But since I'm there, I want to just say a little bit about you. It turned out to be quite a fascinating place. It's a beautiful city. But when I got there, I was asking people that I ran into, and there wasn't very many black people I ran into. It was a town of about 60,000 people. And they told me at that time, back in 62, that there were 5 black families out of 60,000 people lived in that town. A black family that we got to know, because one of the issues were, as we got more black students on campus, people wanted to know where they could get a haircut. Because typically, the white barber shops, you know, either they didn't know how to cut your hair, or you didn't have the courage to go in and see if they would be willing to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And then the black girls, if they didn't have their girlfriends, black girlfriends doing their hair, they wouldn't want to find a beautician. So we became friends with some of the younger blacks in the town of Dubuque. But I never had any real huge problems. A couple of times running out with the fraternity, we were going to places we probably shouldn't have gone anyway. We ran into some issues with race, where someone would say they were not going to serve me, and right away the Phi Omicron was ready to take the place down, and obviously I wouldn't let that happen. And, but overall, it turned out to be quite an experience, and I still today value the town of Dubuque, and a lot of people live there. Many I don't know, it's just because you look at all the colleges in Dubuque,
mm-hmm.
and all the other educational type facilities, it's kind of a little mecca a lot of people don't know about. There's some good people in that town.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Before I get too far away from it, you said you got the opportunity to meet the King family.
Yes. When I went to Ebenezer Baptist Church, I had a little bit of responsibility in the church of making signs. My goal or my ambition when I was in high school was to become a commercial artist. But again, that was just an ambition. Never knew what it would take to become one. Never knew the steps. But I had an art class, and I took a lot of art courses, and I did a lot of painting and so forth. So it was my responsibility at the church, you know, as a kid, to make the signs whenever there was a revival or there were guests coming into town or there were activities like Bible study for the summer or a Bible school for the summer or a revival. So I was doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the best things is that I had an opportunity to do some yard work for the Kings, you know, just go rake leaves or cut the lawn. But at that time, when I had no clue within myself of how dynamic this family was. I knew the pastor, the senior. I knew M.L. King. I knew he wasn't there a lot. He was in and out a lot. And, of course, he was doing his thing. And then he had a brother by the name of A.D. King, who later drowned. I think he was in Alabama. But I was close enough to them to have communicated with them. But again, it was one of those things where I go, wow, because I'm around Martin Luther King Jr., I'm going to be a civil rights worker. I'm going to do this and that. It never entered my mind. And speaking of civil rights, I'll tell you something that was impressive. During the civil rights movement and during the time there was marching going on in the South, there were students, white students, at the University of Duke, and they were going south to get involved, to march. And you're talking about something that was impressive. I don't remember all their names, but I thought, that is really, really outstanding. It told me a lot about that school, told me a lot about Dr. Couchman and kind of kids he brought into that environment. I'll never forget the first time we had an exchange program. Dr. Couchman was a good friend of a gentleman that was the president of Johnson City State Smith University, pardon me, in Charlotte, North Carolina, and they had an exchange program. Again, there were white kids that had to go to Charlotte, North Carolina, to an all-black school for a period of time. I can't remember, I don't know if it was 2 months or whatever, it could have been 6 weeks. And then a group of black kids from John C. Smith came to Duke. Again, I looked at those kids. I think Sherluga was one of the kids, and maybe Dave Bacon as well, that went to John C. Smith University. So, again, I'm around an environment, I'm around people that really stepped up their game to do things that you wouldn't think they would do, because I thought the only white people I see marching are the ones that are jumping on the buses coming out of New York, New Jersey. But that was just probably a small piece of the number of white kids that live in the state of Iowa, or maybe in the city of Dubuque, that got involved in a lot of the things that were going on in the South during that time.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that was quite impressive.
And while the civil rights were going on, I know you said they're students, but were there also instructors on campus that had a reaction?
Yes. I can't remember the name of the instructors. Of course, they had to go. But it was one of those things that was really interesting. None of them would come up to me and say, what do you think about this? What goes on? Because my day-to-day activities were as they should be, going to class, studying, playing sports, working part-time when I could, and coming back, getting resting, same routine. Nobody would bog you down with that, saying, why did you not go? I knew I wasn't supposed to go. I felt bad for a while that I wasn't going back with some of the kids down there. But I think the instructors were instructors. They knew that the kids that were there, black and white, their jobs were to continue moving forward. Now, there was a time I heard, well after I graduated, that there was some racial tension on campus. And I was not privy to all the details, but it really got pretty bad from what I understand. And someone else that came in after I did could probably speak more to that. But it was nothing like that when we were there. Like I say, there were groups, there were cliques and so forth, and that exists anywhere, regardless of the ethnicity. There are going to be groups that do their own thing. So those groups that white kids did not necessarily want to associate with me or did not want to include me in the things that they did was nothing that bothered me, because I had a group of white friends that were always inclusive. There wasn't anything that they were doing that they didn't ask me to be a part of. So there was never an issue where I thought, I want to be part of the 13ers or something like that, their party. Well, I didn't need to, because I had five old friends, and I had Athenians. In fact, the Athenians they were trying to get me to go their way when the Files was trying to get me to go their way. So I made friends in both of those fraternities. I had friends in all of them, though. The A's, the 13ers, what is that other group there? The real bright guys, I called them. I forgot their group. But anyway, you know, It was a great group.
And you said, I mean, it kind of seems as if the university, its own little kind of, you know, its own mecca, like you said. Was the reaction off campus and out in town, like in Dubuque, was that any different as opposed to the way it was on campus?
Slightly, depending on, again, places that you would go to, and that's why I said that those of us that would go off, you know, as kids old enough to have a drink, you know, you'd find yourself in an environment where, you know, once the alcohol flows, someone would be bold enough not to use the N-word, but be bold enough to challenge your presence, either to the point where they wanted to get physical. And as I said earlier, I would go with fraternity brothers. And some of the fraternity brothers would get very, very, very angry about that, and they'd want to take it to another level. But the town itself, I only would experience things when I was in an environment, you know, where there was perhaps a place that none of us really needed to be.
Right.
But as far as shopping and just walking downtown, of course, you know, people are going to look at kids and they've never seen a black person before and that stuff like that. After a while, it really didn't bother you. In fact, you kind of welcomed it because it gave you an opportunity, if you choose to do so, and the parents did not have a problem with it, to reach out to people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really an opportunity I think a lot of us had there, was to befriend a lot of white kids that had never known a black or been close enough to a black to have a conversation. And the relationship that many of us established with those kids, I'm sure, I think probably has, you know, been a significant, had a significant impact on their lives and their families' lives through the years. I have to tell you this here, too. You'll get a kick out of this. When we went pheasant hunting, there was about five of us. And I noticed that we were all sitting around after dinner. Kephar's parents had made us a nice meal. And I was tired. I'm thinking, why can't we go to bed? I mean, so after a while, for a minute there, the guy had left the room. So, and then they came back, and somebody finally said, hey, let's crash. Let's go ahead and, you know, go to bed. So my roommate was Dave Bacon. We shared a bed. So Dave and I were laying in bed, and Dave said, you know, he says, Billy, he says, this is the first time I've ever been this close to a black man. And I said, Dave, it's the first time.
Wow.
I said, it's the first time I've ever been this close to a white man. So we laid there, and we ended up talking for well over an hour or 2 hours maybe about our homes, where we were from, our experiences. And Dave was from Darien, Connecticut. And Darien, Connecticut was a very, very wealthy community. There were three guys there from Darien, Connecticut. It was Warren Reiniger, who we lost a few years ago, and Chunky Farkas, who was my best man at wedding, and Dave Bacon. They were the three great, very wealthy athletes that came out of there in Connecticut. But it was actually, what was it, probably 10 years later or something. I was at the university for a homecoming or something. And Dave came up to me. And that was Kephart, came up to me. He said, Dozier, said, do you know why it took us so long to crash that night? So forth. He says, I said, no, I don't understand what that was. He says, we were drawing straws to see who would share the bed with you. Isn't that a hoot?
Wow.
Isn't that a hoot?
Wow.
But what's even more of a hoot is the fact that a couple of people told me that. And that just told you how close we were, because I thought it was kind of funny, but that's what they were doing. And I drew Dave. And Dave and I communicate right now. He lives in Colorado Springs. A great guy. He was a quarterback. He later became an end for the football team.
But after that, you guys grew to become very, very close. Was that almost immediate, or was that built up over time?
Before, you know, Dave always felt that Dave, of the three guys, Dave seemingly was the most standoffish. Chuck was more engaged, and so was Warren. But Dave and I, that was an opportunity for us to really become very close and become very, very good friends. I guess that's the way God wanted it to be that particular night, because we really got pretty close as buddies after that particular weekend. But as I said to you earlier, I can't tell you what that university, that's two places that I've been in my life where I've, the activities, people I've met have a great impact on my life. The University of Utah was one, and the other, of course, was the United States Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, Dubuque really, really was the place where I really learned, again, to work with all different types of people. And leaving home at such an early age, you know, I didn't share a lot. I didn't have a lot of space in my heart for people that much. It was there. I just did not receive it, nor did I give it back. But it was at the Duke where you had an opportunity to kind of use those gifts God has given you as far as things like love, respect, and appreciation, because it was given to you. And the only way you could, the way you use it is that you gave it back. And as I said, it just prepped me to go on and do some great things, you know, after that. I mean, I could have gone to other schools and probably been met with an entirely different environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Things would change.
So trying to get a better sense of the city and what it was like, was the housing, was that out in town, off campus, was the housing a little, was that happen to be segregated at all here in Dubuque, or?
That's a good question, because there was, and I don't know if it was because it was segregated or because the black folks wanted to be together. There was one little area of Dubuque, I don't remember that street, but on that street there was about three or four black families, okay? Now, that might have been their choice to say, we're going to be where we're together. I don't know if the city had anything to do with that. And then across town a bit, there was probably another two families. And I don't know what drove that. But I don't recall anyone ever coming back to campus saying, I could not rent this apartment because they wouldn't rent to blacks. In fact, I only knew of two or three black kids who were behind me that came in later that did live off campus, downtown somewhere, and none of them ever spoke of any challenges they had as far as getting a place to stay. So I and again, as I said, I worked for the city of Dubuque for a little while in the recreation department, and I forget the gentleman's name that got me the job there, but he's a wonderful man. He was a great supporter of the university. I think I would have seen it. It probably was there, Gordon, but I just never did things that would put me into it. Like I said, the only place that I'd run into problem would be in the bars. And I didn't do that a lot, but when I did go, we were obviously in a place we probably shouldn't have been.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'll say this. It was, I had a worse time in East Dubuque than I did in Dubuque.
Oh, over in Illinois?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that could have been one of those things about college kids, because you know, there was Lawrence was there, we were there, Clark was there, and probably some other schools in the area, and they probably just knew that we were just over there, and there probably were people tearing up stuff or whatever, so we weren't that welcome. And I never really looked at it as being a black thing, because there were several places that we would go that we were pretty welcome, but then there were a couple others that I don't think anybody was welcome there. They went from East Dubuque.
Mm-hmm. Now, what I had heard was if you ventured across the river, it was the drinking age would change.
I think it was 18, I believe.
Right?
Something like that, yeah.
Was that kind of like a typical weekend or like time off thing? It was venturing over to East Dubuque and...
Well, I gotta be careful because this was being recorded. I can't tell you. it was like going to a local. Okay, Dubuque is like your local jewelry store. You know, they have a little bit of everything. So you go there and you have a good time. But when you went to East Dubuque, that was like going to Tiffany's. Okay, because that was kind of a high end, you know. You could break more. You had people coming from all over the area, people are coming from Chicago to East Dubuque for whatever reason, for different events and things like that. So that was like a step up. You didn't see all the same people. You've met a lot of new people, and the real challenge about East Dubuque, though, was making it back to the campus. And that's where you had to be very, very careful because of people drinking and so forth. So in a lot of ways it was good, but in other ways it was a lot of challenges because obviously at that age, you know, those who are trying to drive and drinking, and it wasn't as prevalent as it is now about people getting DUIs and so forth. But that was a challenge, is making it back once you went over. So that sort of kept a lot of the kids from going over that much. But it was like the step up. Going to Dubuque, if you took a young lady downtown to Dubuque, nah, it was all right. But if you took her to East Dubuque, it's Tiffany's.
Now, how did that work? If did you have a car or a vehicle, or did friends or carpooling?
I never had a car or vehicle when I was in college. The friend's car that I used to use a lot was Keith Kephart. And I think Keith had one of those big old Oldsmobiles. So my girlfriend and I, we would use his car to go to a movie. And then Chuck had a car. So there was actually about three guys that from time to time, if I needed to go out and they weren't using the car, I could use their car.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, as far as the other universities within Dubuque, you know, Clark and Loras, did you ever have any interactions? And what were those like?
More with Clark. Because there were other girls at Clark. And I don't want you to get the wrong impression. I think when kids are in college, they, and in my case, initially at Dubuque, there were no other black kids there except Bob and I. So there were a couple of black girls over at Clark. So that gave me an opportunity to go to Clark to visit. I never ended up really dating any of them, but I was invited over to a couple of their events. At Loras, I met black guys that were basketball players that started coming over to the university more, because as this black population grew at Dubuque, there were more black girls coming in. So there was some interaction more then than there was the first year and a half I was there. We would go to large basketball games, and we knew some of the players. They would come over to the university on a Friday and student union, stuff like that. So, you know, as far as any academic or any of the activities from an academic standpoint to colleges, I never did. There was more, it was more social than anything.
Oh, okay. Okay. So during your time at UD, you were in a variety of athletics. I mean, here I've got you did football, and I think you had participated in track and basketball as well. What was that like?
Yes. It was great. I had wonderful coaches. The first coach I had was Moco Mercer, who was a football coach there at the time, and he was later on replaced by Slip Evans. But Moco was the one that encouraged me to run track. And he had me running, at that time they called it the full 40-yard dash. He felt that would help my skills, particularly speed in football, which it did. He also tried to get me to wrestle. But as popular as wrestling was in Iowa, I just never connected with it. What was his name? I forget, Chet Evans, I believe. Name, I think I might have it wrong, but he was the one that, again, encouraged me to play basketball, because he felt that, you know, it would be a way of staying in shape, running up and down the court, you know, to play football. I liked track better than I did basketball. And football was my number one sport. I really, really enjoyed that a lot. And my last coach there was Orne Evans, and I think he had a pretty decent record there. Floors, wins and losses at Dubuke, and that's where, you know, I had a lot of great style friends. But actually, I had a lot of friends at Dubuque that were in the different fraternities, and but most of the files were jocks. We had a good football team. We had a good football team during the time I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I think it's one of the best records that we had. And we just could never get it all over the top. In fact, it was, I think I may have gotten the honorable mention of the All American or something like that. And
yeah, that's what I have here. It says honorable mention, All American linebacker, and All Iowa Conference and All Iowa NAIA football squad.
Yeah, well, I did. I enjoyed the game. There were some decent players. I can tell you this, though. I have never seen guys so big in my life as I did. A lot of those guys coming off the farms in Iowa. I'm talking about these defensive tackles or offensive tackles and ends. Those are some big guys. There were some really, really big guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have here.
No, you go ahead, please.
I have here that we found in one of the yearbooks, actually, that you had a mentioned memory in one of the yearbooks that it was something about your freshman football game, and you had forgotten your shoe, and you had to borrow the kickers and go onto the field that way.
Oh my God, who put that in there? You're right. Can you imagine being the kicker? I mean, it was horrible. What was even worse, if people just laughed. So funny. When we took the field, not playing the game, but you know when you come out of the locker room and you're running, you're charged up. And so I'm running out on the field. I didn't put the shoe on until I started playing. I ran out on the field with one shoe on, one off. And fans were cracking up. Cracking up. I don't know I don't know if I left it at the university or we got lost on the bus or what. But I forget the kicker's name. He was a nice guy, big guy, too. But the coach saw my dilemma, and he told me, asked me, what tattoo he wears. He told me to give it to Dozier. Boom. And I was out there. I'll be dog. I've forgotten about that. All I have to tell you, too, one game I was playing in, I don't want to call the name of the school right now because it probably wasn't fair, but we were beating this team pretty good. I put a hit on one guy close to the opponent's sideline, and this guy told me, he says, boy, if you hit him again like that, I'm going to come out there in that field, and I'm going to kick you know what, personally.
Oh, my God.
He did use the N-word, too. And I smiled at him and went on to my side of the field. But, I don't know if you're talking to any more athletes, but there were a couple of towns where we were not allowed to stay in those towns. I'm not making this up.
Really?
Coach Evans can tell you this. And we either had to drive back to Dubuque or drive over to another city. And I think there's one time, the time we had to drive back, a lot of the white guys knew what was going down. I didn't understand it at the time. But Coach Evans said that something went on where we couldn't stay there and eat, whatever. So we gave each of us $2 or $3, and we went into this little fast food place and bought food, took it back on the bus, and we drove out. But again, it didn't really set on me. It didn't really hit until after we got back, and a few of the guys said, well, you know what that was all about. And that was back in the early 60s. I had no idea.
Wow.
Didn't pay any attention to it, yeah.
You couldn't remember what any of those places were?
No, I don't. I know it was two places. I don't remember. If I call around, I tell you, there's a couple of guys that know right away that were pretty adamant about challenging those type of situations. But I'll talk to Chuck and Keith. They'll probably remember. But I don't remember. I don't remember who we played. I thought about it long enough. I go back and look over the records. I could probably figure that out. But off the top of my head now, I don't recall. But only two incidents where that happened.
Okay. You had said you had a white roommate when you first arrived.
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was cool. I forget his name, because he left after his freshman year. But he was really, really a cool guy. He was from Chicago, and he was very bright. He had the top bunk, I had the lower bunk, and he played a guitar, and he would sing. Mm-hmm. So this one time we went out of town for a football game. I come back, and he had painted the ceiling completely black, and he put a bright light in it. And when I walked in, he was sitting there, all the lights off except that one bright light. and he was looking up into the ceiling and he's playing a guitar. Strange.
That is a great guy.
I know I can't find this thing. I know I can't. I was going to look through my old yearbook. But super guy. I mean, it's kind of like, for him, there's like nothing. It wasn't an issue, but with me, I'm thinking, is this guy really going to be hip? And not feel uncomfortable sharing a room with me? But he was a super, super guy.
So did you always have white roommates then, from that time on?
Yes. Yes. Many of us did. Because, you know, there was one of the things where maybe Bob and I roomed together for a short while. But once you became friends with some of these guys, you know, those were your friends. And if other black guys came in, you didn't drop, you know, the white roommates you played football with or you'd run around with and say, okay, now, Chuck, I'm going to go live with Bill Stubblefield because he's a black guy. It didn't happen that way. It just, once you became friends and all of a sudden you had a lot in common, you decided you're going to share a room with a group of guys or another guy. But I think Bob was the only black roommate I had my freshman year.
Okay.
For a short while.
Now, other than athletics, were you involved in any other organizations or anything like that on campus?
Primarily the fraternity. I think I was in the B Club for a little while. I didn't really get into a lot of the other organizations, partly because I did do a little part-time work, and I had to do quite a lot of studying. It was tough for me. I got a good high school education, but there were a lot of things that I needed to really work a little harder at than most of the kids. So I didn't join things like the Glee Club or the music department and things of that nature. Most of the things I did was kind of like the tied to athletics. And there may have been one or two things I jumped into for a while that I don't recall, obviously, because I didn't stay with it long enough. But no, I didn't do a lot of the other extracurricular activities.
Mm-hmm. But still, for your post office job, right? You never had any issues going around delivering people's mail or anything like that?
That's a great question because I was working in the post office itself. Because during the holidays, Christmas holidays especially, I was mostly handling the packages. You know, once people brought it in, I'd do the sorting.
Oh, okay.
So I never was a deliverer or a mail carrier, so to speak. I was just working in the post office, sorting mail primarily.
Mm-hmm. You think that was ever something that they would steer you away from because you were black, or would that not be a big issue?
I think they would have allowed that to happen. And the reason I say that, I think that there were enough people, influential, involved people in the Dubuque, I mean older people, that was connected enough to the university that if Dr. Couchman called and said, hey, this kid needs a job, and would you consider allowing him to be a mail carrier? I think those are the kind of strings that could have been pulled by the university. So I think from some of the packing plants, to be packing in other places, hired black men or women, I think a lot of that had to do with contacts, you know, kind of who was supporting it, who was requesting it. So I think I would have been able to do this.
You had to know somebody.
Mm. Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So you had said that President Couchman was definitely one of your favorite faculty members. Did you have any specific instances on and stories that you had with interactions with him?
It was always just coming up and talking with you in the hallway or after a game. As I said earlier, too, I'd go over to his house for maybe a Thanksgiving dinner or one of the holidays, maybe it's Christmas Eve or something like that. It was just by chance, most of it. He never would call and say, Dozier, come over and talk to me or anything. It's like, ran into him. He was always very thoughtful and asked how you're doing, need any help, how the grades, how the football. And as I said, from time to time, he would allow me to kind of watch over John. And, of course, I made a lot of money doing that. But that was mostly the association.
Oh, okay. Now, I don't know when the last time is that you've been back to campus here, but I'm trying to get a picture of what it was like during the time that you were there, as opposed to, you know, the way it is now, like physically with the buildings, and you know, you have Severance and Van Vliet and all that kind of stuff.
Well, my first dorm was the girls' dorm down below. Severance was there. My first room was in Severance. That was a boys' dorm at the time. And I understand now it has the seminary in there and maybe some other stuff. And then from there, I went to Stephens Hall, which is now Blades. They got the Blades and all of that. Mm-hmm. It was that one building. That other stuff was not added on. And it's a number of buildings. It was Severance, it was a girls' dorm. It was a sort of mess hall with cafeteria. And then there was Stephens. Then there was a gym. And then later on, they built this real nice building, the sort of a science building.
Mm-hmm.
That came in later. But it was nothing like you see today. It was nothing. I was back there in about 3-4 years ago, maybe 4 years ago.
Okay. Okay. We had heard from Jim Martin when we had interviewed him last week, I think it was, or maybe the week before. But he was saying that there was a hangout spot that was beneath Peter's Commons.
Yes, that was the what do they call that? Glad you mentioned that. That's where we had a jukebox in the corner, and we had a little hamburger type counter there where you could get sandwiches and so forth. And then on Friday evenings or Saturdays, that's where people would have their little parties that didn't want to leave campus. And what do they call that thing now? But it was below Peter Commons. Oh, what was that? Yeah, I remember that well. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of blacks that congregate down there to either play cards, bridge, or bidwits, or euchre, or any of those card games. And you know, have a sandwich with a place to be on the weekends.
Okay.
You know what? I did find the guy was my first roommate. I thought Mike got my book. He was from Glen Ellyn, Illinois. His name is William Westervelt, B-E-L-T, W-E-S-T-E-R-V-E-L-T.
Westervelt.
I see him here.
Okay.
William Westervelt, Glen Ellyn, Illinois. I think he only did 1 year there.
You remember why he left?
No, I don't. No, I don't. Because I think I'd moved to another dorm, moved over to Stephens Hall. I think I became a dorm counselor or something like that. And I know that I think he was still there, and then the next day he was gone. And he just dropped out. But I don't know the main reason.
Okay. So next year, we're putting on an exhibit that is 100 years of the McCormick Gymnasium. And we're trying to go around and get everybody's favorite memory of when they were in McCormick and what that was. And we're going to try to display it. So we're trying to see what your favorite memory is of being in McCormick, good or bad.
You say that like you know something, right?
I know. I'm not saying that I know anything specific.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I should date this really beautiful girl. So I had a responsibility. I think I was doing stuff. Some little job I had as far as taking care of the McCormick Gym. And she loved to swim. So did I. So one night we go into the gym. And we go downstairs to the pool. The pool was, of course, below. So we decided that we were going to go and go for a swim. Because I had a key to the gym. Gym was closed, right? So while we're in there swimming around, the fire alarm goes off.
Don't know.
Yes. The fire alarm goes off. Well, the fire department comes in. And then whoever the security guy was for the pool came in. So that was the most embarrassing time I had there.
And you're still there when everybody showed up.
we were in the water and swimming, and next thing I knew, the fire alarm, I didn't hear it go off. And next thing I knew, the fire guys, the lights coming on, the fire guys, firemen coming down the hill, down the steps. Not a lot of people know that, folks.
Yeah, we've heard a few stories about of people sneaking into McCormick, and whether it's playing basketball or sneaking into the pool or anything like that.
Really?
From a few.
So, yeah, one of the biggest stories. Anyone ever tell you about the lower football field?
No.
Okay, the lower football field, which is now I think is where the team practice. Football team practice. We didn't have the baseball. Well, maybe we did have the baseball field there. But anyway, that was a lower field, the very lowest field. If you go to the stadium now and you look at the level, there's stadium and there's one level there where it's against the baseball, and there's another level. They may have built on it by now. But anyway, the guys and girls that won in the early evenings, the sun was set, they'd all go down and they'd take their blankets down and they, you know, kind of hang out time and stuff. And the key was to get there before it got dark. Otherwise, because there are no lights or anything, otherwise you're stepping on people. You know, you have to kind of weed your way through. And those are fun times. But I didn't go down there a lot. But I do recall a couple of friends and I used to go down. And but it was innocent. It was cool. It was a place to be. You know, you wasn't spending any money. So it was pretty nice. Those are fun times.
Okay. So before I ask you this next question, I have to know, was it Paris Island or was it San Diego?
Paris Island.
Paris Island. All right. I'm a San Diego Marine myself, so.
We used to call you guys Hollywood Marines.
They still do. They still do. To this day, they still do.
You guys have sand fleas there?
No, we didn't have sand fleas. We had mountains, though. That's the big controversy nowadays. It's whether you had the sand fleas or you had the mountains, and people are trying to decide which is worse.
I'll never forget when I went through there. Sand fleas, they could bite, and they really hurt. So if you slapped on a sand flea, the drill instructor would say, "Marine, you just had your breakfast. I'll let them have theirs." And then you drop down and give me 20. You'd open it anyway.
Of course.
Yeah, those things were tough. They were tough.
Mm-hmm. And see, but I was stationed in Beaufort for about 3 years, actually. So I was across at the air station for a little while. So I was, you know, just across town from Paris Island, actually.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How'd you like it?
It was great. That was probably the best thing that I've ever done with my life was going into the Corps and learning everything the hard way.
Yeah, I hear you.
So to speak.
All of a sudden, being reborn again.
Exactly. Starting from the bottom, all over.
Yeah, exactly.
But did you feel that? I mean, you said it earlier that you felt the university really prepared you for everything they came after. You had graduated, and going, I have here that, you know, you were a captain, and you did 1.5 tours in Vietnam, and you received the bronze star with the Combat V for Valor. I guess I don't want to get too in depth with it, but I'm just trying to get a picture of what that was like, just for my own reasons, like trying to see what the Corps was like then.
Mm-hmm. Well. It was, the Corps, as I said, was one of the big turning points in my life. And similar situation I shared with you earlier about, and I'm going to use the term racism, it's probably not a good term to use, but difference, so to speak. I was the only, probably, I know I was the only African-American or black lieutenant in my unit at the time in 3rd Battalion, 26th Marine in Vietnam. And, life fraternities, you know, Marine Corps has a little bit of that too. And As it was in Dubuque, there's always a few people that are cool. You know, they work with you because of who you are and your qualifications and so forth. But I don't want people to think that all of a sudden the Marine Corps is void of any type of race type activity. But it's there, and it's anywhere if you look for it long enough, so to speak. But I had great commanders that gave me a lot of responsibility. And as you know, when running a rifle platoon, you've got all different types of people, and somehow you got to get to all of their minds and their heads as much as you possibly can, not individually as much as through their team leaders and so forth. And as I said before, I think because I gone to Dubuque and met people from all over the country, New York, New Jersey, I don't care. I mean, whenever I would meet someone, we had something to talk about, because there wasn't too many people that I'd meet that I didn't know. Someone that had been in a general area, someone said, I'm from Teaneck, New Jersey, and I'll say, hey, I knew somebody that lived in Short Hills, New Jersey. But it was enough for me to have a conversation with them about New Jersey, and it was building a bridge by having those kind of conversations. So I was able to, I guess, motivate people to do things because they knew first and foremost I was looking out for them. And I had this old saying that if you take care of your people, the numbers and everything else takes care of itself. And they knew that. They knew that they would be first. I've got a radio operator now that I need to call. I had in Vietnam. He's back in the hospital. He got hit with the Agent Orange stuff, and I call him a kid. He's probably in his early 60s, but he was my radio operator during Vietnam. And he once said to me one time is that the reason, and I'm not saying this to blow myself up, he said the reason I'm the man I am today is because I had you as a commanding officer during my last few months tour, you know, in Vietnam. And again, it's because you learn to connect with people. And as I said, I learned that at Dubuque because there were so many different people, exchange students, people from all over the country. And that's the beauty of Dubuque. You got people everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, getting back to my tour, and the Bronze Star thing, we were on a company operation, and it was my platoon that was putting up the rear. And we had discovered movement from the North Vietnamese, and we were able to engage them and prevent them from going into a village. And in fact, we were told later that they were going in to assassinate the village chief, because we had a base not very far from that village. And during the battle, we were able to take out one of the Vietnamese battalion commanders, North Vietnamese battalion commanders. So for that, you know, I was recognized by, of course, the Marine Corps and, of course, by the Vietnamese. I got the Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry with silver, with a gold leaf.
Oh, wow.
That's what that was for. So that's why I was recognized for that. But, you know, like everything else, you don't do it yourself. You do it as a team. And as I said, I had some wonderful young men that were in my platoon. Many I talked to today. There's one who was my machine gunner that lives about 20 minutes from me. And then there's the one that lives in Midlothian, Illinois. He called me the other day. He wasn't doing very well. He asked me if I'd be a pallbearer at his funeral. And not naturally, that took me down. I thought, you shouldn't be talking about something like that. You're too young. So he's had, a battle with Agent Orange. He's had a different types of cancer, and he's on dialysis right now. But his wife just sent us a message the other day that he was readmitted to the hospital. I think it was on Tuesday. I don't know how I got on that, but anyway, mm-hmm. I'll go back to Rachel.
Okay. Now, what was the reason behind that? I know you did one full tour. What was the reason behind that half tour?
I was on a ferry It was the USS Independence. And I was on a Marine detachment. That's when I had enlisted.
Mm-hmm.
And we went over for a while, and that what I considered to be an additional amount, because it was 13 months over there, and then I did three, I think it was, on the USS Independence.
Oh, okay.
Over in the Gulf of Tonkin, we're back. And people get the ribbon, even if they never leave the ship, they get the ribbon for having been in those waters.
Oh, did it really? Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what made you decide to get out? You didn't have any second thought of staying in and going career or anything like that?
I was a career Marine, in my mind, and I was on a fast track. After I got back from Vietnam, I went to Oceanside at Camp Pendleton, and I was a infantry training regiment commander. And from there, they decided they wanted to send me to North Carolina to do some recruiting at predominantly black colleges at that time, trying to convince black kids to look at the Marine Corps as a career path after college and so forth to become an officer. And I did pretty well with it. And after that, my next move was going to be headquarters Marine Corps. That's what they had told me. That was a career path. And I knew there would be, you know, other things happening. So I did the job the best that I could. But during that time, this was like in 70, I think it was, the Black Liberation Army on some campuses, particularly black campuses, was prevalent. And as you know, most Vietnam vets were not that welcome back. There was just a lot of resistance. There would be a lot of challenges on the campuses. I never had any physical altercations, but there was always someone that's telling you that, you know, what you did was wrong, you're a baby killer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I battled through that for a little while. And then two other things happened that inspired me to get out. One was we used to go to this bar. It's in Raleigh, North Carolina. During the day, we had an office right around the street from this bar, and we'd go in for a beer and a hamburger at lunchtime. Of course, we were in our uniforms. So one particular evening, I decided, in civilian clothes, I'd just run by and grab a little sandwich or something like that, and one of the bartenders would not serve me. And, of course, that didn't sit well with me. The regular bartender that I used to run into wasn't there. But just the whole idea of, having served and spent time with what happened with some of the black colleges and then what happened there,
mm-hmm.
started me thinking. And then one of my commanding officer there came to me one day and said, I want to give you a heads up. I think they're going to, you're going to get orders to Cambodia. And I said, I don't think I want to go to Cambodia. I said, God got me out of Vietnam, and I don't want to test him to get me out of Cambodia, because first we weren't supposed to be in Cambodia, and secondly, the people that I knew and a couple of guys from Dubuque went to Cambodia. They were in the army, and they didn't make it out of Cambodia. So I said, I can't do that. I just don't want to do it. I said, I'll just end my career now. And he says, the only way you can do that is resign your commission. So as an officer, you have to resign. You just don't say, I'm out of here, I quit.
Yeah.
So in order to get my honorable, I resigned my commission and decided to get into corporate America. So that was the reason that I sort of got out of there. It was a combination of things. Looking back, though, Gordon, I guess if I had some counseling, by the counsel, I mean shared my feelings with different people and so forth, they would have said, well, there may be another way you can get around Cambodia and yet still stay in the Marine Corps. I didn't solicit that. I just knew that I had an experience that I didn't like, being an officer selection officer and being treated the way I was treated in this bar. I thought, I don't want to be in an environment like this anymore.
Yeah. So what was the next step after the Corps then?
I joined the Lincoln Merchant Division of Ford Motor Company in sales and marketing. I was a sales trainee. First, I was learning how to take orders from Lincoln Merchant dealers. On color selections and equipment levels of different cars, the Lincoln Mercury cars, and that was a training position and distribution. And the next step from there is that you became what they call a zone sales representative. And a zone sales representative was a person who went to Lincoln Mercury dealers in a given territory to wholesale them a certain number of cars. In some cases, you took orders for different cars. In other areas, you sort of pressed the dealer to take cars. For example, all the dealers wanted the luxury cars, but no one wanted Comets. So you tell them, okay, if you want a Lincoln or a Mark, you got to take three Comets. So there was some negotiating going on there. So from that job, having a territory as his own sales rep, he went on to become a manager in either retail management, which is primarily financial, or merchandising, which is kind of help the dealers promote the cars and attract public interest. So I did those two jobs, and then they promoted me to what they call a general field manager. And in that job, I was managing zone sales representatives, people that were going out selling cars. And each office would get X number of cars to sell in different models on a month-to-month basis. So it was in that job that I did 10 years there. And a good friend of mine, Bill Stubblefield, who I think you talked with briefly, Bill was working for American Hospital Supply Corporation, and I told Bill, called him one day, because I was on a pretty decent fast track at Lincoln Mercury, and I told him that they were going to send me to Detroit. And I'd gotten a call from a good friend that was already in Detroit. He said, you don't want to come to Detroit because people can't get out of here. They can't sell their homes. That's when the business was in the 70s, late 70s. It was getting pretty tenuous. So Bill said, hey, you need to talk to American Hospital Supply Corporation. In fact, there's a job in California that I think you might be able to get if you just talk to the president of this division. Talk to this guy, got the job. So I went to American Hospital Supply Corporation, and I worked for them primarily in sales force development, executive sales management, running. I had my first job with them. I was a region manager. I had anywhere between 12 and 17 sales reps that called on the folks in the the biotechnology, environmental, and the microelectronics market selling scientific-type supplies. Then was promoted on up to an area vice president where I had the half of the United States. I did that. And then the company went through some things where we were acquired by another company. Long story short, I worked there, and again, the scientific industry, as a senior area vice president, again, in sales and marketing. And I later on left there, because a different company, and I started my own business for a while, did that for about 6 years. And that didn't work very well, so I had to close that business. Really interesting story. We had more time, I'd tell you all about it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a good business. It was a distribution business. I was distributing the same type of products that I was distributing when I worked for American Hospital Supply Corporation, which later on became Baxter, and the division Baxter I was with sold to this other company. But I ran that business for about 6 years and did a pretty decent job there for about the first 2 or 3 years. And then the person I bought the business from joined a company that I had an exclusive relationship with, and immediately had that company set up other distributors,
okay,
so to speak. So I began to lose a lot of revenue that way.
And mm-hmm.
Went back into corporate America. After I closed that down, back to the old company I was with, became VWR International. And then I did about 2 years, you may have heard this, is in fund development with the university.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
I was there a couple of years. A new job, new position. It's just one of those things where it was kind of experimental. And the main job was trying to get people from the West Coast here, and of course, any other area, but primarily the West, the graduates out here to, or alumni out here, to start giving back to the university. So it just was a slow startup, didn't work. It wasn't bringing enough money in my opinion, and I'm sure the university's opinion, to support the cost of the job.
Mm, yeah.
So that's why I got away from that.
Okay. So I have here, I mean, as we're talking about civil rights and such things, I hear that you served as chairman for the Diablo Black Men's Group. What exactly is that, and can you tell me about it?
Well, the Diablo Black Men's Group was a group of black men that live in a predominantly white environment. It's an area of what we call the Tri-Valley of Contra Costa County, and the black population is probably 1.5%. And there were a lot of African-American families that were moving into the community that, you know, wanted to find out which are the best schools and where does my wife get her hair done, where can I get a good haircut, blah, blah, blah. So we decided to form, so as men came in, like Chevron was where a lot of guys were coming in. So we started having breakfast meetings, about six of us. And then we thought, well, why don't we form a group that any black family moving in, we offer to allow that person to become a member of the group, and we'll share things with them about the school systems that we know about, the police departments, because a lot of the blacks moving into the area were affluent, and their kids might be driving a BMW, a 320i or something, and police not seeing a lot of that would think, well, maybe that's a kid out of Oakland, California that's stolen a car out of Danville, California. So we began to have meetings with the law enforcement, school teachers, and so forth. There were things like Martin Luther King's birthday was not recognized. There was nothing that was being done. It wasn't a militant-type move to say, don't you think that these kids, you know, not black kids, need to know about this. So we were able to have some influence on the community as far as recognizing the fact that more and more African-Americans were moving into the community. So it initially started out more social and more of a networking, kind of a fellowshipping type organization of African-American men. We started in 1999. It still goes on right now. Believe it or not, they have a couple of white members who are married to African-American women. So they still exist. They have a nice scholarship program where they award about 10 scholarships every year to under-resourced young men in the Contra Costa County area. So it's still doing pretty well.
Wow, that's awesome. Well, that's pretty much everything I have for you right now. Is there anything else that you would like to mention or that you would like to say before we part here?
Well, there might be some things in the tape you might want to edit. So if you want to send it to me, I'll go ahead and take some stuff out of there. No, it was a good life. It was a good life. There's great people that I met. And I'll tell you again, very quickly here, I really, really thank God that I was able to have that experience at Dubuque, because I can tell you that if I'd taken that other path that I shared with you about just getting involved with having a nice car, lots of money, working as a waiter, no matter what may have happened to me,
mm-hmm.
You know, because I would not have had the education, I would not have a network of people. I would have had a network. It may not have been the best network of people. And I can tell you this, that most of the folks that were in that particular group were not all people that were looking to take going to the next level. I learned what the next level was, and I thank God that I had an experience at Dubuque, and Dubuque was a great place. It could have gone the other way, but it didn't. It was just a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Well, you certainly had a great story to tell
for
this. I really appreciate your time and being able to get a moment to talk with you today. And everything.
Thank you.
And I appreciate everything you've done for the university and for the Corps. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you
very
thank
much
you
for your time.
As well.
Awesome.
All right. You take care now.
You too, Mr. Jones.
Thank you.
Bye.